Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. I'm going to be real with you. Identity theft is on the rise, and you do not want to wake up one morning and discover that your bank account has been emptied, or you're overdue on credit cards you never even applied for. We talk about this often on the podcast, but you don't realize how much of your information is available to scammers on the internet and how susceptible you and your family are to identity theft and fraud. I know, it's scary, but now you can get your data removed with Delete Me. That's why I personally choose Delete Me. Delete Me is a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential ID theft, doxing, and phishing scams. I just started using Delete Me and I got my regular personalized privacy report. I was shocked what they found and removed. It was pages of information about me that I did not want online. Here's how it works. You sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. I cannot tell you how relieved I felt to have Delete Me. And you know, it's also a great service for your parents or grandparents to help protect them from identity theft. Delete Me is not just a one-time service. Delete Me is always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you do not want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special price for my listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use promo code ETM at checkout. The only way you get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and enter code ETM at checkout. joindeleteme.com/ETM. Go to joindeleteme.com/ETM and use code ETM for 20% off. Hey, I'm Shauna Compton Game. This is Millennial Money, and today we have a Millennial Music Chat with Drew Holcomb.
She was a good companion, eyes like the Grand Canyon. She was an American beauty. She was a long goodbye, she was the best alibi. She was an American beauty. With her wafers on in the summer sun, her touch felt like a loaded gun. Wish I had held her longer. Wish I had held her longer.
Hey there, and thanks for joining us this week on Millennial Money Lifestyle Thursday in what we're calling our Nashville sessions of musical guests. You may have heard Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors' music on such TV shows as Parenthood, How I Met Your Mother, and Nashville. This Memphis-born and now Nashville transplant has been making a big name for himself and even touring with such big acts as the Avid Brothers. Drew is one of those laid-back guys that you just want to sit down, have a beer with, and talk about your love of music. He's also one talented singer-songwriter who has a new album due out in March, as well as kicking off a national tour later that same month. Last week, Sean and I sat down with Drew Holcomb at his Nashville office to talk about his new single, Wild World, playing the Stagecoach Festival in California this year, and singing a Ryan Adams song in front of Ryan Adams when he was a young performer. So enjoy our conversation with Drew Holcomb from Drew Holcomb and the Neighbors. Okay, cool. So, Drew, thanks for coming on our show on Million Money.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, it's been a minute since your last album, Medicine. I saw on social media that you're working on a new music. So, how's that going, and when we might see it out coming out?
Yeah, it's going great. It's the new record's finished. We recorded it in November, mixed it, and mastered it over the holiday, and sent it into the presses, if you will, vinyl and CDs. We still print a few CDs. And it comes out March 24th or 25th, somewhere in there, whatever that Friday is.
Right.
So yeah, it comes out in just a couple of months.
Awesome. Can we expect, is it a different sound, or it's in the last couple albums, or is it kind of around the same?
Hopefully it's a progression. A couple of big differences between this record and the last one. I co-wrote with my band for this record, mm-hmm. so it has a lot of their fingerprints on it. They tend to be quite a bit more musical than I am, just in terms of arrangements and stuff. So it's got more of a Beatles vibe, more of a 70s kind of, there's just a lot more going on. But I think the heart of the record is still my voice, and still similar, kind of point of view. But it definitely was fun to have more cooks in the kitchen. You got a little, obviously that usually gets messier, which is good.
right. Well, I mean, was that a natural progression? You guys just kind of did it that way, or was that you were kind of,
well, honestly, I kind of after Medicine, I kind of hit the wall, and yeah. I felt like I was out of gas, and I was out of things to say, and I needed to bring in some help, and Rich and Nathan, my two long-term bandmates, have been guys that know me and know my point of view probably better than anyone else besides maybe my family. And I just said, guys, I need help. I need y'all to start writing with me. So we started meeting every Monday morning, mm-hmm. whenever we weren't touring, and we'd start writing, and we'd mm-hmm. write until the end of the day, and came up with a lot of the stuff that ended up being on the record. And from that, I piggybacked and was able to go out and write my own, like write alone as well for the record. So it's a good mix. But you hit the end of the road, and you kind of say, I don't know what's next, and around and see who's standing there with you.
Right, exactly. Well, I do love the single that you put out pre-election, the Wild World. How did that come up? And because you also mentioned that you feel kind of confused as an American this year.
Sure.
I mean, how did that come out, the album? That single, I should say.
Yeah, well, I wrote that song a couple of months before the election. The intention was to save it for the record, but it felt like, knowing that the record wasn't going to come out for the spring, that a lot of the point of view of that song would have been a little bit lost. I mean, I certainly don't think it's lost now, especially with the results of the election, maybe more pertinent than ever. But yeah, I just think the kind of level of discourse that we've seen in the last year and a half has reached levels that I never thought I would see. Mm-hmm. It's been incredibly disappointing for me, and I've never been a political artist like real openly. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times music for people is a way that they like to kind of center their life and step away from the chaos of politics and personal drama, mm-hmm. and try to make sense of some of the like core things about who we are. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, at some point, I felt like I had to say something,
right.
And that was sort of my something to say.
Right. And you had a nice, cool black and white video to go along with it, too.
Well, thank you. That was really thrown together. I was like, this song's coming out next Tuesday. I called a buddy. I was backstage at the Country Music Hall of Fame for an event. I was playing two songs, and I had like 2 hours in between sound check and when I performed. I was like, hey, can you come in this little green room and shoot this video? And put it out.
I was literally
48 hours later. Yeah.
It looks cool.
Well, so. Thank you. Yeah. Like, that's all his doings.
Right. So the term Americana, it's used a lot more recently and stuff like that. But you've been making music for a while. Can you describe your sound and do you kind of try to label it one way or kind of evolve in different sounds all the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I first started out, people would say, what is your music? And I would say, like, oh, it's like folk rock. You know, I didn't really have like the Americana category at that point was sort of meant more like bluegrass, and it was a little more of a smaller tent. Yeah. And kind of in the last decade, I kind of love that term grows and grows every year in terms of what fits under that, you know, under that umbrella. So, yeah, for me, I think that, like, I just kind of define myself as a singer-songwriter, and, you know, the way we record is and the way we play live is that everything that you hear live and that you hear on the record was performed by a human, you know, in the real moment. And so I've always thought of Americana music as kind of this like music with warts, music with honesty. Right. You know, we don't go in and fix drum tracks and put them on a grid and.
Right.
We don't replace people's performances with computers, and we don't tune my vocal. It's kind of like, let's do it till we get it right, and then put that out as like a as like because all my favorite records are like that. You know, you hear about the way Tupelo Honey is recorded, or the way that National Skyline is recorded, and it's like get a bunch of really good musicians in a room who love songs, and great things happen. You know, and yeah, Americana, I guess, is a good kind of word for all of that, but yeah, we're glad to be in that family, I guess.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, and now, you know, there's so many groups that were, you know, like even like a Wilco or a Dawes and stuff like that can almost be in that
totally.
Band too, and
totally.
Stuff. And they've been bluegrass or alt country or
alt country. I used to get that tag, you know, and then. It's funny though, because I never like was a country fan. Even I mean, I respect the medium and the genre, but if you're like, you know, Drew, name your top 10 concerts, like probably none of them are going to be country shows.
Right,
like, I just didn't listen to that growing up. I was listening to Radiohead more than I was listening to, you know,
right.
George Strait.
Right.
But I did fall in love with like some of the songwriting in country music, and it's just interesting how like. All the genre barriers have sort of melted,
right.
but it's also like that's only true for people who pay attention to music a lot,
right?
You know, people that sort of like music still think in terms of like, you know, like if I meet somebody on the airplane and they're like, "What kind of music do you make?" And I'm like, "Well, it's like Americana." They're like, "Well, what does that mean? are you country?" And it's like, "Are you rap?" You know,
right.
"No, are you pop?" It's like, "No, well, man." You know, like, there's a little bit of pop because I love the Beatles, and, you know, it's just like, it's kind of a great puzzle.
Right.
No one can really solve.
Right. You just stop and just say, I'm rap.
Yeah.
I'm around.
My wife just started saying, they'd say, "What kind of music does your husband make?" She goes, "It's just good.
It's
good music." You know, I was like, "Oh, thanks, sweetheart. That's very kind."
Exactly. So you grew up in Memphis, and obviously people think of one dude when they think of Memphis, as well as blues and stuff like that, Elvis and stuff. Who were you listening to besides like Radiohead and stuff like that, that kind of made you want to be a singer?
So I think I was listening to all kinds of music as a kid. I mean, anything from Ben Folds and Bob Marley to, you know, whatever was on the radio, Savage Garden or whatever, you know, I mean, it's like kind of whatever, and then whatever came through town at the Beale Street Music Fest every year. But I didn't really get into songwriters. My dad was a big Dylan fan, and he was a big fan of Al Green, you know, which another great songwriter. So those two were kind of in the blood. And then in high school, the songwriter that really first captured me, made me want to emulate him, was David Gray. I was a junior in high school, driving to see our senior in high school. I was driving down to see my sister, who was a college freshman down at Ole Miss. It was midnight, and a friend of mine had ordered his CD from Columbia House, UK. It was $28. She couldn't even get it in the States.
Right.
It was White Ladder.
Right.
And I was just like, man, there's like all this soul and storytelling and emotion in his voice and the acoustic guitar. Super simple. And I just was like, man, I want to do something like this. And then from there, I got introduced to Whiskey Town, Ryan Adams, Patty Griffin, Emmylou Harris, Springsteen, Tom Waits, And it was literally like every time you open a door, you go into a room that's full of all this amazing music, and there's 8 more doors. You know, and that's been the last 20 years of my life.
Right.
Yeah, David Gray is definitely one of our favorites. We went to one of his concerts a couple years ago, thinking, oh, you know, his album's great. Like, all right, this will be a good show. And he just blew us away live. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, he's such a great voice, such a great stage presence. Big epic songs. Yeah. You know, there's like a melodrama that I appreciate in earnestness, you know.
Right.
Like Shine, you know, it's like, if I don't sing this song right now, I'm going to die.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. So both you and your wife, Ellie, obviously are musicians. She recently put out an album. You have a family as well. You know, how do you balance that all, being two musicians and having a family? And is that tough to do?
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, you know, you have this like traveling lifestyle, but you also have the reality of kids. I mean, like last night, even Ellie had a rehearsal all day this morning, and last night Emmylou got a stomach bug and was up all night. And so Ellie's going to rehearsal on 3.5 hours of sleep. You know, we're both, you know, managing touring and interviews and all these things that are part of the job of like wanting people to know about your music and wanting people to show up at your tour. But it's really just a matter of like, it's a lot of juggling and a lot of patience for each other. You know, cause I think the marriage is the like fulcrum that takes the most pressure. And so you have to like really be on the same page and remind each other. We have this thing we say to each other, I'm not your enemy, you know, and it's been a really helpful way for us, cause she actually toured with me for 8 years. So that's one of the beautiful things about our relationship, is she knows the road and she knows music, and she knows the tests that are out there, and the lack of sleep, and the beat up, your body getting beat up from traveling. And she has a lot of wisdom and patience for that. So, but like anything, it takes a village. I mean, you know, we've got a great team of people, and one of the things I love the most about doing music is that I never thought I would love is just like the practicality of human relationships that make music work as a career. You know, tour managers, drummers, merch guys, booking agents, sound guys, security people. I mean, these are all people that got into the music business because they love music, and yet they still have to sustain. So we always joke about, like, you have these dreams. Like, for me, it was becoming a musician. And your dream comes true, and you're getting to do it, and you're making a living. And then the hard part is managing a dream come true.
Right.
You know, because there's a whole load of disappointment and frustration on the other side of anything that you love, if it comes true, just as much as there is if it doesn't. And so I think for us, we just have lots of open communication between each other and with our band and with our management. And as we've gotten older, we've toured less and focused our touring more and learned to say no to things. And more than anything, kind of like, make decisions and let the chips fall and not try to micromanage everything after the decision's been made.
Right.
Yeah. Is she going on the road with you too, coming up? Or?
She does not. Yeah. No. I mean, she'll come out occasionally.
Yeah. Right.
But no, she's got quite a bit of her own work on the books. And then also she, you know, likes to be home as much as possible with the kids.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of live shows, the last album you had was your live at the Ryman. How did that come about, and why did you want to have a live album coming out?
Yeah. We recorded that whole tour just because our sound guy, Thomas, is had the capacity. He's like, well, I'll just bring Pro Tools rig. And we had the same board every night we rented, you know, for the tour. And so we recorded every night, not with any intention of, like, maybe we're going to do, like, a Medicine Live, you know, not knowing if we do a particular show. But we came off stage at the Ryman. It's, like, dream come true venue, number one venue on the bucket list.
Right.
The night felt absolutely magical, and we're coming off stage, and Rich, my bass player, who's a very, like, non-emotive person, comes up to me, gives me a big hug, which I don't think he's given me a hug ever before, gives me a hug, pulls back, and with tears in his eyes, he says, that's the best damn show we've ever played. And then I said, well, a couple of months later, I was like, well, I wonder if we should release that show. and Rich and Nathan were like, I don't want to ever hear it. Like, I had this mythology in my mind of what it sounded like, and I don't want to hear it. And I was like, well, I think I do. So I told Thomas, I said, you go listen to it. Tell if it is as good as we think it is, let's talk about it. If it's not, just tell us, guys.
Yeah.
There's some problems with the recording. And he called me a couple days later and he said, man, you've got to release it. It's as good as you thought it was. So, you know, we didn't have some master plan of releasing a live record, but we've never released a live record. And that show just felt like the one to release. And it's been fun to have that for fans and with this record club we do. We have a subscription-based record club that I started.
Yeah.
And we really did it in a lot of ways for that because we have, you know, a lot of subscribers and we got it printed in gold vinyl and people really responded well to it. Just kind of a moment in time, you know. Live records in a lot of ways are very, like, self-indulgent.
Yeah.
But thankfully people have responded well to it.
Well, I think it's also changing too, especially like how like a Third Man Records or other places you can get live recordings and stuff and how they're different and they look different and how huge vinyl is crazy. I mean, because I grew up with vinyl.
Yeah, it's blown back up.
And then now all the young kids are like, oh wait, what's this vinyl stuff? And they listen to it and it's like, wow, it's incredible.
Yeah, I think people are just like, young people especially are like searching for something physical and tangible that they can like identify with, you know, and they're like,
yeah.
It's a way to say, like, I don't just kind of like music.
Yeah.
I love music.
Right.
You know,
right.
I think that's really neat.
Right. What's the best part about playing live for you?
For me, it's like the translation of the songs and looking at people and seeing some of them respond and realizing that actual people have let your music into their life, you know, and you're kind of going, like, you hear these stories, like, when I was in the hospital, I gave out my P.O. box and people wrote all these letters about, I asked the question, like, how'd you hear music? I'm going to be sitting on the couch for 3 weeks. Like, I'm reading through these letters from people and it's like, I heard your music through my friend when he was going through a hard time. He gave me this mixtape and you're on it. Or I was watching this show and your song came on. Or my dad got cancer and your record was our soundtrack in the hospital and he's doing better now. And, you know, just hear all these stories about stuff and you realize, like, these are the people that come to the shows. Like, you know, I would say at this point, because I've been doing this long enough, like, there's not a lot of casual drop by, oh, it's a $10 cover, because that's not what it is anymore. It's
right.
A ticketed thing.
Right.
People are coming with their friends. It's like something to do. But also because of their music. And we have people that travel to see us play from all over the place. And these are people that have, like, let a song or a record or a group of songs kind of into their psyche and into their soul or whatever. When I think about the music that I love and the shows that I go see, it's like every song that I hear that I know I love takes me somewhere in my own life. So that to me is the most satisfying part of playing live, because you don't see that when you're, people are listening to your record and you're not there. No. You don't know what's happening.
Right.
But to see it in real time is very satisfying.
Right, right. Are you always writing songs, or do you have to kind of like hold yourself away and go, okay, I got to crank out some songs?
Yeah, it's a little bit more of the second. I mean, I don't write all the time, but I'm kind of collecting and musical ideas or song pieces all the time. But to actually sit down and finish songs for me kind of comes in waves. Yeah, so it's, you know, I'll take, typically like once I record a record, I'll take time between then and when the middle of the first part of the tour, so that the old songs that have just been recorded still feel fresh. Because even though they're not new for me anymore, they're new for the audience. And so
right.
You hate to get on stage and feel like your best song is the one you just wrote that's not on a record yet, and that's all you want to play.
Right.
It's sort of distracting for me.
Right, right. Is there any new music these days that you're listening to? Really into?
Yeah. I'm going to butcher his name, but there's this guy from Canada named Leif Volpeck. That somebody sent me the other day that I really like. It's got a song called Elegy that's really blowing my mind. On the record club, we just did this two new records I really like. One is Rhiannon Giddens' Freedom Highway. She's okay. From the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
She has this new record that she kind of based.
New Basement Tapes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. She has this new record that she wrote kind of based on different kind of narratives of the kind of African-American experience starting kind of pre-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
It's really intense and really good. And then Laurie McKenna's record, The Rifle, the, I can't remember the whole, it's a long name, but she's so great. She played our Moon River Festival, and I got to know her and fell in love with her personally, and then also her music, and that record's been on kind of repeat in our house. But it's the great thing about nowadays, there's like so many great records coming out all the time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was singles kind of being driven on iTunes and stuff like that, but you actually, I discover like, oh, I like that's the one song, and I'm like, wait, this whole album's really good.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of come back in a, you know, that way nowadays.
We've even learned, like, we've put out some singles here and there, and people just don't really pay attention that much, but when we put out a record, that's when, like,
right,
everybody's like, yeah, single.
Right.
Like, give me the record.
Good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, give me the record.
Right. So you guys have a big show coming up at the Stagecoach Music Festival in California. How did that come up this year?
Yeah, well, you know, we kind of send our agent like a list of festivals we want to play every couple of years, and we're way too like middle of the road for Coachella. You know, it's just like it's like that. I don't know who it was, John Stewart or somebody, like, did that video making up fake band names,
and all the kids were
pretending like they knew who they were.
Exactly.
You know, so there's, like, that's one thing interesting about country, where we can kind of, even though we're not a country band, we're kind of, like, there's a little bit of, we can kind of grab onto the coattails, because they're song people, you know, so that was a festival I just thought, man, it'd be fun to go out to the desert and play for these folks from Southern California, and I feel like they'll resonate with what we do, and it'll give us a good excuse to build a little West Coast run out of it, so
right.
Really looking forward to that.
Right, that's awesome. What's one of your favorite stories on the road?
Favorite stories on the road. Let's see. That's a good roadkill stories. We got a turkey flew into the side of our van one time and took off the side mirror. My favorite story on the road was when I was very young. I was touring and I played for the first time in New York. And it was probably like my 15th show I'd ever played. And I was playing Tuesday at 7 o'clock, which, you know, New York, everybody's still at work. There were probably 12 people there, including the staff. And I started covering Ryan Adams, Oh My Sweet Carolina, and he walked into the bar while I was playing the song. And then afterwards, I went up to him and was like, well, you know, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, my friend's playing later. Come back and we'll talk, you know. So I come back at 11 when his buddy's playing. The place is packed by then, which was only like 50 people. It was a small place.
Yeah.
And I grabbed him and kind of was like, hey, I'm the guy from earlier. And we sat and talked at the bar for a minute. And after everybody left, after everybody was finished playing, he got up and played and then invited me up to sing Sweet Carolina with
him. Wow.
And then he rolled and never saw him again.
Wow.
So you still haven't seen him.
Right.
So, 12 years later.
So Ryan, Drew's waiting to have
coffee. Just want to say thanks, man.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.